In the administrative area of Auschwitz, just yards away from the machinery of death, Nazi officers and their families lived in relative comfort. Children played in gardens while smoke billowed from nearby crematoria. Officers' wives exchanged recipes and gossip as trainloads of victims arrived. This is the disturbing reality Martin Amis explores in The Zone of Interest, how the extraordinary evil of the Holocaust existed alongside the utterly ordinary rhythms of domestic life. The Zone of Interest itself, the Nazi term for the area surrounding the camp, becomes a powerful metaphor for the moral abyss at the heart of human nature. Through three distinct narrators, we witness how easily people can compartmentalize horror, how bureaucracy can sanitize genocide, and how love can flourish in the most unimaginable circumstances. The novel forces us to confront uncomfortable truths. The Holocaust wasn't carried out by monsters, but by ordinary people who somehow maintained their self-image as decent human beings while participating in industrial-scale murder. What makes this reality so disturbing isn't just the scale of atrocity, but how familiar these mechanisms of self-deception feel. How many of us look away from injustice when confronting it might cost us something? How easily do we accept euphemisms that mask uncomfortable truths? The novel's brilliance lies in its rotating first-person narrative structure, offering three distinct perspectives on the same horrific reality. Golo Thompson, nephew of Martin Bormann and an IG Farben representative, embodies the reasonable Nazi, privately disapproving while continuing to benefit from and enable the system through self-deception. Paul Dole, the camp commandant, represents the banality of evil. His sections focus on bureaucratic language and technical concerns, train schedules, disposal methods, fuel efficiency for burning bodies. He obsesses over administrative details while remaining detached from moral implications. The moral center comes from Shmuel Zacharias, a Jewish prisoner in the Sonderkommando who processes the bodies of his fellow Jews. Introducing himself as the saddest man in the lager, his unflinching self-awareness gives his narrative power. He acknowledges his complicity while maintaining resistance, bearing witness, and occasionally saving lives. These three perspectives create a kaleidoscopic view that exposes the psychological mechanisms enabling atrocity more effectively than any single narrative could. At the heart of this novel is a disturbing romance between Golo Thompson and Hannah Dahl, the commandant's wife. Their attraction unfolds against the backdrop of mass murder, raising profound questions about how desire can exist alongside moral catastrophe. Their clandestine meetings create a cognitive dissonance, a conventional love story amid horror. Hannah is complex and ambiguous. Though married to the camp commandant, she despises him and the Nazi regime. She remains haunted by a past relationship with a murdered communist professor. Is her attraction to Thompson genuine, or is she using him against her husband? What makes this romance so unsettling is how it reveals character. Thompson desires Hannah while remaining complicit in the camp's operations. Hannah resists the regime, yet participates in the camp's administrative social life. Their love doesn't transcend the horror, it's entangled with it. This relationship forces us to confront uncomfortable truths, our capacity to compartmentalize, pursue personal happiness amid suffering, and maintain self-deception about our moral standing. The novel explores how ordinary people become participants in extraordinary evil. Language functions as a tool for deception and psychological distancing, with Nazi euphemisms creating a parallel reality where mass murder becomes mere logistics, evacuation instead of murder, special treatment instead of gassing. Physical and psychological compartmentalization enables atrocity. The camp separates killing areas from administrative zones, while perpetrators develop defensive mechanisms, heavy drinking, bureaucratic obsession, rigid domestic routines to avoid confronting reality. Perhaps most disturbing is how victims become unwilling cogs in their own destruction. The Sonderkommando, Jewish prisoners forced to process victims' bodies, represent the ultimate perversion of human dignity. This forced complicity embodies one of the Nazi system's cruelest aspects, making victims participate in their own dehumanization. This machinery operates simultaneously on linguistic, psychological, physical, and social levels, creating a self-reinforcing system that transforms everyone while maintaining an illusion of normality. As Germany's fortunes change after Stalingrad, cracks appear in the Nazi narrative of invincibility. Young Wolfram Prüfer initially clings to propaganda until his facade crumbles. He eventually confesses that encircled soldiers have begun to see their suffering as divine retribution for their actions in Ukraine. Paradoxically, as military defeats mount and resources dwindle, the killing in the camps accelerates. Schmuel observes that, though the Germans cannot win against the Allies, they may still complete their war against Jews, revealing that Jewish extermination took precedence over military victory. The changing tide creates ripple effects through the camp's bureaucracy. Paul Dahl faces increasing scrutiny from Berlin, while pressure to increase production at Buna Werke intensifies despite scarcer materials. These administrative challenges continue alongside the machinery of death, creating a surreal parallel where efficiency reports and production quotas exist alongside mass murder. The novel builds toward Walpurgisnacht, April 30, Hannah's birthday, Hitler's future suicide date in 1945, and Schmuel's scheduled execution. This convergence creates an apocalyptic sense of personal, historical, and metaphysical forces colliding. Dahl forces Schmuel into an impossible dilemma: murder Hannah or watch his own wife die. This exemplifies the Holocaust's choiceless choices, where victims faced only horrific outcomes. Yet Schmuel finds a third option, reclaiming moral agency by turning the weapon on himself. His declaration, "Really, he wanted me to do this to you," exposes Dahl's true nature while asserting his humanity. His suicide becomes resistance. By declaring, "With this final act, I prove my life is mine alone," and burying his writings to ensure not all of me will die, Schmuel transforms his death into an act of bearing witness. The novel's aftermath dismantles any possibility of healing. The perpetrators meet their fates. Bormann commits suicide, fleeing Berlin. Paul Dahl is hanged at Auschwitz, still delusional. IG Farben executives receive unexpectedly light sentences. The emotional core lies in the final encounter between Thompson and Hannah in 1948 Berlin. When Thompson suggests a future together, Hannah responds devastatingly, "Imagine how disgusting it would be if anything good came out of that place." This rejection of redemptive narrative becomes Amos's philosophical cornerstone. The Holocaust represents not merely a historical atrocity, but a fundamental rupture in human understanding, a black hole in our moral universe defying both reason and representation. The novel refuses the comfort of meaning or closure. The aftermath eliminates every avenue of consolation. Even the pursuit of justice through trials appears inadequate against the crime's magnitude. The novel implies that attempting to find meaning in such events constitutes its own moral failure. We must remember not for comfort, but because remembering is our only defense against the unthinkable's return. The Holocaust wasn't perpetrated by monsters, but by ordinary people who believed in their own decency, an uncomfortable truth demanding eternal vigilance against the machinery of dehumanization that persists today.